I would now like to welcome Sean Ferguson, Dean of the Schulich School of Music here at McGill, a composer whose work bridges the areas of musical creation and scientific technological research. Dean Ferguson joined the McGill faculty in 2003 and was named Dean in 2011, and he will introduce our first panel. Dean Ferguson.
Thank you very much. Welcome. I'm delighted to have been asked by Will to be the honorary co-chair of this conference of the McGill Institute for the State of Canada. It's a great honor. I thought that the proceedings yesterday were absolutely fascinating. I think I and I'm sure everyone else who was there learned a lot and really found it a very valuable experience. And I think that today we can look forward to some other great sessions. I'm looking forward to this one in particular. I'm going to pass to Kevin Tierney, who is going to lead this next session as a chair. I'd just like to say, if you ever get an invitation to a dinner party where you'll be sitting next to Kevin Tierney, take it, because I had this last night. It was really a blast, although he does use bad words. But otherwise, I'm sure he won't do that today. So please welcome Kevin Tierney.
He's a funny old son of a bitch, that Will, isn't he?
Oh, sorry, I won't.
We did have a lovely dinner last night. Let me introduce the people on the panel, if I may. Filmmaker Jennifer Jonas. She's been nominated for the TIFF CMPA Producer of the Year Award 5 times, and I know she's going to win. As the first assistant director, her credits include The Red Violin and 32 short films about Glenn Gould. Sports editor Steve Mache, thank you for telling me how to pronounce it. Prior to joining Sportsnet, Mr. Mache was editor-in-chief at Canadian Business and a columnist at Maclean's Magazine. Andy Nolman. Not a lot of people know this, but when Andy Nolman met Gilbert Rozon, he was 6'1". Isn't that true? He's the co-founder and president for life of Just for Laughs. And a funny guy. And beside me to my right, Kitty Scott, who is the Art Gallery of Ontario curator of modern and contemporary art. And prior to joining the AGO, is that what they say? AGO? The AGO. Ms. Scott served as director of visual arts at the Banff Centre. So welcome to you all. And it's a little daunting to try. I've done a bunch of panels in my short life. But I've never done one before where we actually get to cover visual arts, comedy, cinema, and sports. So if there's not something for everybody in this all-dressed pizza, and it's pretty early to have pizza. But we're going to start with Kitty, who is going to present us with a little short presentation. Thank you.
I just, since I work in the visual arts, I thought it'd be great to actually have some slides with me, so I'm just going to show you a few pictures. First, I want to say it's an honor to be invited to this conference. It's an honor to be invited to this conference, and I just want to say thank all those who made it possible. I want to speak here about two different streams of activity and experience. One concerns artist residencies, and the other concerns retrospectives at major museums. From 2006 to 2012, I ran an international artist residency program at the Banff Centre. One of the primary streams of the program brought together professional, meaning generally young MFA graduates, artists, critics, and curators from around the world, but primarily Canada, US, and Europe, for an intense six-week period of original study conceived by an invited artist faculty. Residencies offer artists a unique opportunity to explore, expand, and develop their practices, as well as facilitating theoretical and intellectual growth through interactions with other artists, visiting faculty. The Banff Centre offered the luxury of time and space for artists to create new works, research, and experiment. Each residency was a one-off experiment. Unlike a university, we had new faculty each residency, and we are non-parchment. Ken Lum, who was faculty, there's Ken there, is a well-known Canadian artist, has an international reputation. He would come in and run a program, and he would say to all of the participants of that program, I can't fail you, but I can make you feel like I failed you. I organized the program in such a way that the majority of this faculty came from abroad. Ken was an exception. Although there are a range of high-quality MFA and PhD programs in Canada, art students here have little durational contact with international artists. At most, a guest from abroad may visit a Canadian educational institute for a few days, but artists need to get to know their international peers. I just thought I'd show you this slide. This is one particularly lively residency where at the Banff Centre, for most artists, the Banff Centre is a kind of luxurious resort hotel compound. They don't come into that kind of environment very often at that stage in their careers. So they thought the bathrobes in the room were hilarious and decided that they needed to wear those bathrobes all the time. So this particular group, it looks like a strange cult in the mountain, but really it's just artists being artists together in space, in nature. So at most, a guest from abroad may visit a Canadian institute for a few days, but artists need to get to know their international peers. So in having international artists in Canada for longer periods, we provided an alternative to the status quo. Over meals, hikes, and film screenings, and with lectures and studio visits or crits, the younger artists gradually understand and recognize the ways in which the faculty think, their attitudes and approaches. So I would say at the Banff Centre, while you're in these kind of maybe somewhat traditional teaching situations, more is learned by actually sitting down with your peers, having dinner with your peers, going on a hike, being out in space with them. What is distinct here is Banff's spectacular location, which allows for an intense form of togetherness. Free from commercial and professional pressures of their everyday lives, participants are literally stuck on the side of Tunnel Mountain, the location of the center, where friendships and allegiances form quickly. Running this program for 6 years, during which the art market's voraciousness dictated careers and trajectories to an unprecedented degree, the isolation of Banff offered a space, if only temporarily, outside the vicissitudes of the market for artists to safely experiment. Failure in Banff does not register. So the idea of failing, we talked a lot about that yesterday, and it's very, very important for artists to have a space to do that. Just you might think this looks like a kind of traditional person out there painting in landscape, sort of Group of Seven style. It's an internationally renowned performance artist called Ragnar Kjartansson, and he's actually performing plein air painting. So he's not a plein air painter per se. He's performing that act. So that's a document of that kind of activity. So a kind of experiment, if you like. From this brief introduction to my work in Banff, you get a sense of the artist-led programming and how extracurricular events are integrated and all fit together. Visits to the center are generally periods of intense and intimate exchange, and I think it is important to emphasize that there is no expectation on the artists who come here to produce anything. The lack of expectation opens onto a larger question about the place of artistic residencies and changing notions of creative or intellectual labor. What is the place of inefficiency or non-productivity? Do we need to create spaces in which artists can precisely risk failure, spaces that are removed from the market and its relentless demands for new product? My current position as chief curator of modern and contemporary art at the Art Gallery of Ontario has entailed a shift in my responsibilities. While I continue to support younger artists, I also have the opportunity to develop and enhance reputations of mid-career and senior Canadian figures. One of the most powerful tools for doing so is the retrospective exhibition, a large-scale venture that assembles a representative body of the best work made by an individual artist over the course of his or her career. What does the career of a successful Canadian artist look like? Well, they've been making work for 20 to 25 years. They have a strong reputation with international artists, critics, curators, collectors, and dealers. In other words, they have a great network. And they're exhibiting regularly and fairly consistently at high-caliber museums and galleries, both in Canada and outside. And finally, these same institutions have been collecting the work of these artists. So you'll find their work in the collection of the Tate or the Museum of Modern Art, all these great museums around the world. It's a very tall order. Many artists have adequate careers, but few artists ever succeed at this level. I'm just showing you a work by George Burrs Miller and Janet Cardiff, who are two sort of exemplary artists. They work together. This is a work called Paradise Institute, so it's a kind of box. You move inside, it's as if kind of gives you the illusion that you're sitting in the box of a theater and looking down over the theater, and you can watch this film, and there's headphones that you wear. So it's a kind of immersive sound cinematic experience. So two Canadian examples of the collaborative team, Janet Cardiff and George Burrs Miller, and Jeff Wall, so a Vancouver artist. Some of you might be quite familiar with him. It's a work by him, Destroyed Room from 1978. An artist like Jeff Wall has had a retrospective at the Tate in the Museum of Modern Art. Often a retrospective exhibition travels to numerous countries, so an ideal circuit might look like the Museum of Modern Art, Tate Modern, and the Centre Georges Pompidou. Institutions like the Art Gallery of Ontario have a crucial role to play in the promotion of such careers, but I would caution, as with artists at the start of their professional lives, here too our most effective gestures require outreach beyond our borders. Even major museums like the AGO or the National Gallery struggle to attract the audiences that peer institutions in global cities like London, New York, and Paris count on. The visibility of Canadian art at this level depends. Is that okay? Is that your timer?
I'm setting my alarm for me. I'm so embarrassed. Hold
okay.
On.
It's okay. 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 I'll just read that last couple of sentences again. I'm almost done, though. I was on my last sentence, so I thought it was a timer to get rid of me. But anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's what it was. It's the AGO person I'm auditioning. Continue. Sorry, Kenny.
Even major museums like the AGO and the National Gallery of Canada struggle to attract the audiences that peer institutions in global cities like London, New York, and Paris count on. The visibility of Canadian art at this level depends on our willingness and ability to partner with other top museums, Tate, Museum of Modern Art, the Pompidou, in the organization of retrospectives. While I have been discussing a set of responsibilities, however, working with an artist, whatever the level of achievement, is usually a great privilege and something I'm highly passionate about. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please set your alarm to go off in about 5 minutes. Andy Noman is next.
God.
Try to make noise at an inappropriate moment, please.
Oh, how embarrassing. You know what I was doing? Seriously, what I do, because I use the iPhone, I set an alarm. So when I say you got 5 minutes, I set the alarm so it goes off. So I was just choosing what noise would be there, and I didn't figure it would go off. So how embarrassing. I'm so sorry, Kitty. You know, and I'm trying to suck up to Kitty because I have a big contemporary art collection at my house. I wanted to come see it and evaluate it. Well, there goes that. Okay. Well, you could just, you know, at the 5 minutes, you just throw water at me or something. Whew! Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, every time I get to one of these events, I ask myself one question, and that is, what the hell am I doing here? I don't know. I always find these like too heady for me. But and then the other question that I get, it always seems to bother me. What's the name of this conference again? This session. Because this is an important piece.
Sustaining a career.
Yeah, sustaining a career. And that's the thing that bothers me, because I always think that, you know, why do we always doubt ourselves? Year after year, this is my third time doing this conference, we always seem to continually be doubting ourselves. So I can only talk, obviously, not on decorum or on contemporary art, but I can talk about show business, and because that has been the realm and what I've been exposed to the most of my life. And the reality of our show business versus the rest of the world's show business is this. Everyone else must deal with the American machine, but no one else is this close to have to suck in its exhaust fumes on a daily basis. Yes, we all know the American machine is bigger, has more money, more scale, and as our downstairs landlord has undue influence on what we see and what we hear. And my answer to that is so effing what? I'm tired. I guess I'm tired of the old argument. Can we have a career in Canada? You know what? I've done pretty good. 36 years, and I have very little talent. Okay? So the fact is, if I can manage to have a career here over 36 years, imagine you, smarter people than I. I just came back from a television show we're producing in Toronto. It's called Deal With It. It's a hidden camera game show. And I'm looking at people who have lasting careers in this business. It's unbelievable. They are technical people. They are writers. They are computer design people. They are camera people. They are sound people. They are costume people. And these people work constantly. It's unbelievable. We have a hard time getting them because of the fact that not only do we produce television, but Americans produce television, and other people from around the world come here to produce television. And you know what? These people, they produce television. The costume designer has her own television project. So these people are working. So it boggles my mind sometimes when I see these titles of these conferences saying, you know, can we have a career in this country? It kills me. So, you know, I know that the business is different. And I'm going to give you an example also with Deal With It. It's a format show, which means somebody in Israel actually created the format, and they sell it around the world, so they give it to Canada to produce, and to Norway to produce, and to Paraguay to produce, and to Mexico, because they give the format the rights in each country. Well, guess what? We just found out after two very successful years, the format was sold to Howie Mandel to do a Canadian, to do in the United States. So the big fear right now is what happens if he takes this show, makes it in the States, and sells it here? And suddenly, the value of my show is basically minimized. So what happens then? So people say, well, the CRTC has to step in. And yes, there's all this government intervention, but there's two things that can happen. A, the CRTC steps in, or B, our show is worthless. So what happens then? I have to go out and either cry or moan, or maybe what I can do is create my own format and sell that around the world. So that's the difference. I've really had it up to here with moaning and crying. If somebody in Israel... And believe me, I have no prejudice against it as a Jew. Believe me, I'm actually proud they came up with this. If somebody in Israel can create a format that's sold around the world, so can Canadians. We can have a lasting career, but I guess what we have to do is redefine this career. We have to, as Canadians, because of scale, because of the United States below us, because of all this, we have to be willing to settle for something a little bit more modest or something a little more different. And there's nothing wrong with that. Where does it say that one career size has to fit all, where one career in the business of show has to be this? That's what it is. That is the golden ring that you have to reach for. If that's not the one you get, then it sucks. Nothing wrong with that at all. But look at Kevin, a very successful Canadian producer. Did he win an Oscar? No. Has he ever been invited to the Oscars? No. Does he bemoan that fact? Of course he does. But but Kevin has made a great career, a great life, and what is wrong with that? Look at me. I'm never going to play in the NBA. So what? So what's the big deal? So it kills me sometimes when people say, Canadians, oh my God, we're not going to be as big as Americans. So effing what, as I said before. All this reminds me of a great joke. I hope you've heard the joke of the elephant hunter, where you see a guy standing on the corner of Peel and St. Catherine with a big gun. And the police come up to him and say, sir, what are you doing with that gun? He goes, I am a very successful elephant hunter. And they said, sir, there's no elephants around here. And he goes, you see? So it's a very important joke because I'll let it sink in for a bit. It's early. But this is the basic story of a Canadian showbiz. Either you go where the elephants are or you stop complaining that there are no elephants here. So this session is called Staying Power. And immediately when I heard of it, I thought of Viagra because of, the natural connection between the two. Greta, I'll explain that to you a little later on. Don't worry. That's a joke, Greta. Please don't have me excommunicated from this country. It's staying power, Viagra. And seriously, I thought of our own Viagra. And it's a Viagra that we can use, anyone can use, and it's called the Internet. This is something that I got into really early, and it's become the great equalizer. The Internet has basically changed all the rules, where it doesn't matter where you are, the world is open to you if you're smart enough and if you're lucky enough. I give the example of a couple things. One is really a good one, one sucks, but it is a good example. I don't know if you've heard of the oatmeal. Most people haven't heard of the oatmeal, but the oatmeal is, you've heard of the oatmeal, sir. It's a comic strip that some guy in his basement has put together, and it's become massive, and now it's become a book, and now it's become, people are going after it for rights and trying to animate it. Now, this guy was one kid in the basement with a great idea, and it latched on. The Internet can change it all. The Internet is staying power. The Internet is the difference that will hopefully allow us not to have conferences like this in the future where we have to ask ourselves if we can have a career. I'll give you one more example. Sucky one, but it actually works, and that is, I hate to say these two words, but Justin Bieber. Justin Bieber. Again, you laugh, it's not, oh, I can't believe he said Justin Bieber at the McGill Highfalutin Conference. Oh my God, sacrilege. But here's a kid who started on the Internet, put his videos out, was discovered, and look at him now. Not everyone's favorite, but the fact of the matter is, a little Canadian boy right now on the world stage. Why? Because of this great Viagra equalizer called the Internet. So basically that's it, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a late night for me. I played hockey. I was terrible. I couldn't sleep all night. So if I have to bemoan anything, I'll bemoan my lack of prowess at hockey, but I will stop. I'm tired of the complaints. I'm tired of the moaning. I'm tired of the excuses. And I'm tired of speaking at conferences where we have to always question ourselves. We can do it. It's just about what we choose to do. So thank you, and on to somebody else.
I think there's a few important things to retain from that. Sean, he swears more than me. Two, but he just uses letters. And for you young people, stay in the basement. I don't know what you're doing down there, but Jennifer, we weren't going to do presentations, but now we are. I hope you have a presentation, Steve.
Thanks, Will, and everyone for the fantastic work putting this conference together, which gives at least people a chance to say why are we having these conferences. Quoique je vis à Toronto, je viens de Montréal. My father has been a professor at McGill my whole life. I grew up on McTavish, and one of my earliest memories is the realization that the McGill campus was not actually my personal backyard. I fell into filmmaking completely by accident while I was doing my first degree here at McGill, and I continued making films while I was doing my second degree at Cambridge. My first feature film experience was on Quest for Fire by that French filmmaker Jean-Jacques Annaud, and I had the fortune thereafter to work with Alan Rudolph and William Friedkin, and then later I did six films with François Girard, a Quebecois filmmaker. And it's perhaps because of those experiences with these fiery filmmakers that my film company, New Real Films, has ended up working in auteur-driven or art film, perhaps, which is its own kind of business. Looking over the themes of this conference and thinking about things we were supposed to think about, the tall poppy syndrome and the supposedly decaffeinated nature of Canadians, I can tell you that in feature filmmaking, you know, you have to be an espresso drinker. There is no decaffeination. And one of the wonderful things about feature filmmaking is that it's a green activity, meaning intellectual property. It doesn't pollute. And yesterday there was talk about the necessity of strengthening Canada's IP or intellectual property rights management. And certainly there is work to be done there with respect to public policy. Filmmakers are not the species, at least the filmmakers I know, who have annuities. They are the species who think nothing of using their own house as equity to close their financings. You start with honing a script, which becomes the blueprint, and then you cast the creative collaborators both in front and behind the camera. You then have to sort of pitch or sell this castle in the air, and that's a very entrepreneurial activity because it doesn't exist for a long, long time. It exists as an idea. And then you find the right technical team, and you build the right score, and you license the right songs, and you make the right graphics, and you close the insurance and the interim financing, and somehow the castle in the air that's just been a series of ideas, somehow it becomes real. The Canadian writer, Margaret Lawrence, an astute observer of the world around her, once said, "One can write of events in a small prairie town, and everything that happens there in some way happens everywhere." And so that, of course, is equally true of Canadian movies. Canadian filmmakers have universal stories to tell, and we're good at making them. The challenge, and Andy briefly referred to this, is the conundrum of awareness. The Motion Picture Association of America uses its muscle to make sure that cinema exhibition in Canada stays stranded as a provincial jurisdiction. In other words, no federal policy can help us out. And with the global trend away from cinemas to online consumption, which of course is the great equalizer, but it compounds the awareness conundrum. I consider myself lucky to have grown up in Montreal during the compelling balancing act by two visionary leaders, Pierre Trudeau and René Lévesque. Canadian identity was valued and fueled by their high level of discourse. This led to a time when the National Film Board financed movies when the CBC actually played Canadian films and the federal feature film agency, Telfilm, believed in developing Canadian talent. Another federal program, Trade Routes, allowed Canadian artists of all types to travel the world to cultural events to export Canadian culture, which in turn amplified the artist's own pride. Sadly, the zeitgeist has changed, and these programs no longer exist. So, sustaining a career in feature films, 20 years ago I helped make a film called 32 Short Films about Glenn Gould that Kevin referred to. That film was entirely financed by three federal agencies, the NFB, the CBC, and Telfilm, and we gave a starring role to Colm Feore, who at that time was a prestigious actor in Stratford, but not known in cinema, although Kevin went on to give him a fabulous part. That same filmmaking team went on to make The Red Violin, which won an Oscar for Best Musical Score. Well, that Gould film would not be possible to be made in the country at this time, and that's something to think about. We're a far cry from the days when a Flora MacDonald or a Sheila Copps led policies that supported the kinds of endeavors or thinking that I'm talking about. Belief in the value of Canadian cultural identity, I'm sure, still exists, but are in pockets that are difficult to mobilize. Quebec is protected by its language and its distinct society laws. And English Canada is a distinct society too, but as Trudeau said, Canada is like a mouse in bed with an elephant. No matter how friendly the beast, one is affected by every twitch and grunt. And these days, I guess he would have said, by every tweet and post. The thing is, in Canada, we're deluged with the reports of the twitching and grunting of our elephant neighbor, as has already been referred to, and it's difficult in the English-Canadian cultural business to compete with this. I'd like to close quoting René Lévesque. There is a time when quiet courage and audacity become for a people at the key moments of its existence the only form of adequate caution. If it does not then accept the calculated risks of great steps, it can miss its career forever. So I remain hopeful soon that the essential survival of Canadian cultural identity will become current in the common discourse and that calculated risks will once again yield great steps. Thanks for having me here today.
Get to the podium. Isn't that a sports metaphor?
I didn't prepare a presentation because I didn't think we were doing presentations, but that's okay. First of all, thank you very much for having me here. It's a real honor to be part of this panel. As a matter of fact, Bad Cop, Bad Cop was one of my favorite movies, as was 32 Short Films about Glenn Gould. I love coming to Montreal for Just for Laughs, and just last weekend I was at the AGO with my six-year-old daughter feeding her voracious love of modern art. I'm not sure where that's headed, but that's it's exciting for me. So thank you very much for having me here. The key question that we were asked to think about before coming up here was, of course, whether or not Canada has a system to nurture elite talent, I think, and to sustain a career in each of our areas of expertise. Mine is the world of sports, and I guess the very short answer from my perspective about nurturing elite talent in the world of sports for Canada is that no, we really don't have a system that nurtures elite talent and supports a lifelong career in sports, at least on not on the scale that a lot of people would like to see. The other half of the, though, and I take Andy's point that we shouldn't be up here bashing Canada, is I actually think that might be okay. Every once in a while we get into these debates about whether or not we adequately support athletics and high-end sports, and then that debate dies down and we go back to concentrating on the other areas of public policy that Canadians in general feel are of more pressing concern and in more greater need of the state's support. But it's that's a very blanket statement, and the truth of the matter is the world of sports is not monolithic at all. It's very complicated, and you almost have to go sport by sport and level by level, and in some cases province by province, and I won't bore you by going through that great checklist, but I will note that in the big professional sports, the big four professional sports, take football, baseball, and basketball. If you are an elite talent, at some point, you are going to leave Canada. That's the only way to do it, to take Andy's point about going where the elephants are in the United States. If you are an elite level soccer player, you are more than likely going to leave and head either to South America or to Europe. That's where the elephants are in those sports. The one exception is hockey. We develop elite talent in hockey in this country. We pour enormous resources into it. We pay great amounts of attention to it. And once you develop that elite talent in hockey, most of that talent is going to leave and go to the United States and not come back. And that bothers us on some level. Every once in a while, things will bubble up, and people will say, well, why don't the great free agents, for example, come back and sign with the Montreal Canadiens or the Toronto Maple Leafs or one of the other great teams in Canada? We have that image of going out and playing road hockey as a child and pulling over the sweater of the team that we cheered for as a kid. And, of course, everybody would want to do that when you reach the point when you can. But, in fact, the market forces intervene, and the vast majority of that talent chooses somewhere else. The pull of home is not nearly as great as we would like to imagine it to be. And again, that's okay. When we're talking about amateur athletes at the Olympic level, for example, we've made great strides there. The Own the Podium program that the Canadian Olympic Committee has put together over the past few years has created more incentives to reward elite-level talent, but we're still not at the level that a lot of other countries are. We don't worry about that except when the Olympics are on. The Olympics come around every 4 years for winter and summer, and we go through the ritual of wringing our hands and saying, why aren't we winning more gold medals? Shouldn't we be better? Shouldn't we be more like Australia? They've got the same rough population as we do, and, you know, a Commonwealth country, we should be like Australia, and they win a lot more medals. And we worry about it, and we talk about it, and then the Olympics end, and 3 weeks later, everything goes more or less back to the way it was. And when you talk to somebody like Alex Bauman, who was running the Own the Podium program until a couple of years ago, last year actually, he moved to New Zealand, and he was very gracious on the way out, but when you spoke to him one-on-one, he said, the truth of the matter is, our heart still isn't in it. It's still not in it to pour all those resources that we need in order to develop that talent, to concentrate on the people that we believe can win gold medals, to channel our support to those people. We still have, even at that elite amateur level, a participant culture, which rewards the idea of supporting as many people as we can. And unless we are going to make choices and identify, no, that person has a chance for a gold medal, and you, I'm sorry, do not, so we are not going to support you, and we are going to support this person, that's how you get gold medals. But that's not what we want to do. Deep down inside, as much as we talk about, it wouldn't be great if we were on top of the podium more, when push comes to shove, that's not what it's about. When you talk to the average Canadian, something that the Kitty mentioned about the Banff Center really resonated, about creating a space to fail. That tends to be the way people in Canada approach sports. We have a participant culture. We want to encourage kids to get involved because we see lots of benefits in terms of physical literacy and health. We see the benefits in terms of social self-esteem, rather, and team building. Those are the things that we want to get out of sports. It's not about creating elite talent who are going to go on and become multimillionaires. If they have that kind of talent, they will go to the United States, they will develop their talent most of the time at the NCAA level, the U.S. colleges, graduate to the pros, sign a multimillion dollar signing bonus, become a quasi-celebrity, and that's great, but they never come back. Personally, I think it's not broken. I think for the most part, yes, we should support participation of children's sports. We should encourage them to rise through the ranks. If there is elite talent, we should show them the path to go. But if we're kidding ourselves and thinking we're going to create an elephant farm in Canada so that nobody ever has to go to the United States in order to cash in, that's just not going to happen. They have an enormous, well-developed, well-funded system of professional sports, and that's, there is a path for people to go to follow that dream. But for the most part, it's not going to be in Canada. But that's not to say that there aren't great benefits happening within the Canadian sports system. That's my take on it, but I'd be happy to discuss further. Thank you.
You know, if somebody had told me this morning that the central metaphor of the session would be an elephant, I'd have said, come on. Can I just ask each of you one small, short question, and then we can get into a discussion with the audience? In just looking at it from within your own field and domain, what do we do right?
Who's first?
In terms of what does Canada
sure.
do right?
First?
Anybody just
what do we do
it's
right?
A toss-up question.
Yeah, I think what we do right these days is just I'm seeing a lot of the grassroots level in terms of tech entrepreneurship. I know I'm harping on that, but tech entrepreneurship. We in terms of some of the educational programs that are out there, I think that we are understanding that my main message is that size really doesn't matter, and you can be that outlier. You can be that little. A pest and make it through rather than be the big, how would you put this, the overcat. You can be the underdog versus the overcat. I think for years Canada has sort of, there's that sense of vulnerability, that inferiority complex. I think that we're coming out of that. But I think there's a realization that it can happen. It can happen on a world stage. And I feel that seems with some of the government programs that are being put into place. And look, I'm the last person, although we take government grants for our events, I'm the last person who says, let's just always run to the government for help. But on the other hand, I think the government is getting smart in seeing what it has to create. So I think we're creating that culture of, I hate to sound like a motivational speaker, but creating the culture of we can do it, and for lack of a better term. But for many, many years, it was that, the Canadian underdog inferiority complex, I think, hopefully, is going away.
Kitty?
We produce artists of an international caliber here, and I think we have great educational institutions. We have great role models living in the country. A lot of Canadian artists, actually, they do have to go abroad to become famous, but they don't move abroad. They actually stay in Canada. They like living in Canada, which has been quite different from what everybody else has been saying here. The Canada Council is a great help in incubating and supporting artists. So I would say education, the Canada Council. We also have a great infrastructure for artists coming out of school with artist-run centers. We have museums spread across the country, so we have an infrastructure as well. It's the question, though, of sustaining a career, and an artist really needs to be showing all the time, and there are only a few galleries, finally, in Canada, in the main cities, major galleries. You think Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, of course, there are other more regional galleries, but those are the major ones. After that, you really need to be in Europe, more so than the United States, because the art market, the art world in the United States is really just LA and New York. Again, there are a few scattered places across the states that matter, but what really matters is in Europe in terms of the way artist careers develop. So you need to make it over there. It's really important. But artists do come back to Canada, the ones that are famous and do really well.
But that presumably that's not a unique experience to Canadians. I mean, if I was a Bolivian artist, I too would want to go to Europe in order to create a career or to
I think there's a whole tradition of artists moving from the regions to the center. Cezanne going from the countryside to Paris. Somebody like Picasso who moved from Spain to France. Artists do move around; they're nomadic. I can't say there's a generalization here, but I'm just talking about right now with successful Canadian artists. So.
Jennifer.
One of the things that Canada does really well, and Andy referred to this, is that on the film crews, both in production and in post-production, there are so many outliers, people who are very good at dealing with the Canadian economy of scale, meaning that with very few days or very few weeks, they can still do remarkable things, and that is a very rich asset that we have. Actors, too.
In the world of sports, I think one of the things that we do well is we do a pretty decent job, can always do better, but do a pretty decent job of promoting the value of participation among kids. And I think it's worth noting that the one area where we do have a track record of developing elite talent tends to be the place where we have the most trouble remaining focused on the value of just getting kids involved, and that's hockey. That's, of all the minor sports, that's where you will tend to see the biggest distortion of perspective, I think, with parents being overly focused on getting their kids to the pros. And I think that by and large, when you look at the other sports like soccer and baseball and basketball and even football to a certain extent, and the other amateur sports too that don't get as much attention, we do a pretty decent job of letting kids know that there is value in just getting out there. There's value in learning how to be part of a team. There's a value in the physical health elements of being involved in sport, and I think that to the degree that we are focused on that participant culture, we're doing something right.
Yes, please.
Because I think what Steve is saying is something that permeates throughout and should permeate more, but in terms of art, in terms of, let's say, television and live, in terms of film production, I think that that same element of go out there and do it is being promoted. And I think that it's key, it's important to say that there is really the boundaries have come down, the Berlin walls and iron curtains that have prevented us from going into these industries are coming down, all these industries. So like that just do it element, you know, again, to coin to use the phrase Nike coined, is becoming, you know, prevalent in all industries. Because why can't I try that? Why can't I make a movie? I can make a movie, I can make a movie with this and actually a pretty damn good one. Why not? So if I can make a movie with that, why can't I try? I can do art. Look at my own son. I have a 22-year-old who's in a furniture-making school. First of all, the fact that we have in Quebec a furniture-making school is astonishing, and it's great. And the fact that the stuff he's making is mind-boggling, and he's making art. And that's and no one's saying you can't, and you won't be able to sell it here, and you can't do it this way, and you can't scale that way. It's you just do it. Just do it, and then let's see what happens. But unless you take that, you know, I keep on going back. As I said, I'm so tired. I'm getting these phrases from songs, but from the band Squeeze. You have to throw the stone to get the pool to ripple. And that's basically what you said. Just get out there and do it.
And to say to the kid who makes the movie on his iPhone, you know, that's never going to win an Oscar. Or I can't see that having a very big opening weekend. Is really missed the point completely of the value of getting involved in these pursuits.
Lucas's first film didn't win an Oscar. Lucas's first film didn't have a big opening weekend.
Yeah.
He just sold his company for $400 billion, so whatever it was.
So are we talking about changing the measurement of what we call success? Is that what you're saying? Is that in doing it? I mean, you know,
it's not like let's give a medal to everybody and you finished 27th and here's, you know, best finish above 30. You know, it's not that. But yeah, I think that you are changing the measurement of saying part of it is just doing it. Part of it is getting off the ground. And that's, I think that's phenomenal versus, you know, the usual, you'll never and it can't and we don't do it that way and you got to go here to get it to happen. So I think it's very positive.
I want to just talk about, as I'm a tennis fanatic, the whole idea of one person becoming famous in their chosen field as a locomotive for changing our perception. I mean, I think Milos Raonic has changed for, you know, completely the way we view tennis.
Yes.
Right? And it's, you know, no one's going to say, well, yeah, but the top six guys from Spain didn't show up for the Davis Cup, so of course we won. We're in the quarterfinals, we're happy. And we've got this kid, this giant child, who's fantastic and is kind of, how important is that as a factor in creating a different attitude towards success?
I think it's enormously valuable, and you're right, Milos Raonic is focusing more attention on tennis, and I have no doubt that hundreds or thousands of kids will pick up a tennis racket because of the success that Milos Raonic has had. That success, to me, and the pride that we can all take in him as a Canadian, is not diminished by the fact that Milos Raonic decided a few years ago to move to Spain, more or less full-time, to train in Barcelona, because that's where the greatest facilities are and the teaching and that sort of thing.
And better weather.
And better weather, yes, which is a factor. I think we still see him as Canadian. He is no less Canadian by the fact that his talent drew him elsewhere to continue to develop that talent. And I don't think that the value of Milos Raonic is necessarily that he is going to spawn a dozen more Miloses. You know what I mean? I think the value is what we said off the top, that thousands of kids are going to be inspired to pick up a tennis racket and try it. And the chances that any of them are going to match Milos' success are minuscule. If they do, fantastic. But if they don't, it's by no means a failure, and it's certainly not a failure that in order to develop his talent, he had to go to elsewhere.
And presumably sustain his own career. I mean, isn't that what the Justin Bieber thing is? I mean, isn't that, again?
I use it almost as a facetious example, but I got to tell you something about fame. I don't know anybody famous who's happy being famous. Very, very, except those people who are famous for the sake of being famous, the Kardashians, you know, people like that, basically, you know, throwaways and disposable human being elements. But the fact is that when you find, I don't know any famous person who would not want to be anonymous, who would say, oh, please, okay, I've had it. It sounds so enticing. It sounds so, you know, that is the end result of what I want to do. But anybody who's got it says, oh, geez, I just want to be able to walk my dogs and go have a coffee in peace. So fame as an ultimate goal is the wrong goal. Being satisfied, being happy, being content, and being able to be free in what you do, that's the goal. Except that, you'll be again, with the American machine below and everything permeating up, you say, well, fame, I've got to be famous. It's horrific. So fame is just a false goal. And believe me, as I said, once you get there, you say, oh, Jesus Christ, please take me back. Give me a fake mustache and a baseball cap and let me enjoy my life. So that is a false, false goal. I think that's one of the great things Canada does well. It doesn't make people famous. It doesn't. You know, a Canadian Star is anonymous. Hallelujah. You can make money and go to the dry cleaners. Can life be any better than that? Yes, you can have somebody come to your house and pick up your dry cleaning. But, okay.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a story. The person that was mentioned earlier, my good buddy Colin Fjord, Tony, came back from New York last week and said, what were you doing in New York? I had a meeting. What do you do for a living? I'm an actor. He said, and this is Canadian immigration. And, oh, really? Anything I might know? He said, well, bulk up, back up. He said, oh, the one with Patrick Huard? He might want to be just a bit more famous. I don't know, but I was actually referring to the success of a Justin Bieber. Does that generate, you know, thousands of kids? I mean, I wonder about the success of an individual and its repercussions down into the system of people wanting to. I mean, would we see that in the? If we had I'm sure we have many Andy Warhols.
If you look at Vancouver, we, for some strange reason, the kind of, I think, majority of internationally successful Canadian artists live in Vancouver. People like Stan Douglas, Ken Lum, Jeff Wall, Rodney Graham, Liz Megor to some degree. It tends to be a male-dominated scenario, but these people all live in Vancouver, Ian Wallace, but they teach as well, and they've been, I think, really strong mentors and really strong models to younger kids. And the kids see this, they see how the system works, and they're able to kind of follow on and move on and develop in the same way. So I think it's a great thing to have strong models living in your community visible. Of course, artists don't have the same problem as comedians or sports figures. Nobody knows who they are. You know, you think about Emily Carr, she's somebody who really was given very little notice during her life. You know, it was only toward the end of her life people even recognized who she was, and her kind of greatest achievements have come posthumously. So artists have a very different kind of career lifespan than a celebrity, sports figure, what have you.
Jennifer, you mentioned earlier François Girard, I think, is a perfect example of a kind of career, sustaining a career, that really, you know, that was not what he originally set out to do. I mean, you have a filmmaker who gets an international reputation off an auteur film and then goes on to direct opera, Cirque du Soleil, Lepage does it here too. I mean, is that something you think of as being one of the benefits of being Canadian? Does it give you that more accessibility? A Goyen's done it. I don't know too many Hollywood filmmakers who've directed operas, for example.
Well, you know, François went from filmmaking to directing for the Cirque, but he doesn't really spend much time in Canada anymore. I mean, the circus that he did in Japan meant that he lived there for a long time. He has a house in Los Angeles now. So, yes, he was able to do those things as a result, but he isn't really, like the next opera he's doing opens in New York today. So I think, as you were saying, the ultimate for that means that he no longer works here in the country.
And do you think do you regret that? Or is that just,
I don't think he regrets
it. No,
exactly. I mean, it's the nature of opportunity, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
And if we're talking about staying power and sustaining a career, you go where your career takes you.
Yeah, and I think the people who have that kind of elite talent are completely comfortable with that. But there can be spin-off benefits for the country from having very successful filmmakers and directors and artists and performers. A lot of the benefits stay even as they go, if you know what I mean, and just in terms of participation and inspiration and that sort of thing. And different people are going to have different goals. You mentioned the tennis players. I mean, if among those thousands of kids who do take up tennis, there are a couple of Miloshes, that's great, and they will have a different set. They will have a different idea of success from the thousands of others for whom that is never going to happen. And they will, and tennis will just become another part of an otherwise hopefully rewarding life.
Okay. Questions? Your turn. Who would like to start it off? Okay. This guy's trouble. He looks like trouble.
Matt Zimbold. Andy, I have a problem with what you're saying on one level, and that is that I think there's a big difference between low self-esteem, national low self-esteem, and good public policy to support culture. And I think that if you look at the Quebec model, where artists and comedians can sell out a whole tour of soft seaters for weeks and weeks on end and do 100 shows, and then compare that with what's happening in English Canada, where, as far as I know, there are no comedians who live in Canada who could do the same thing, what happens is it means that we're not telling our own stories. And it doesn't mean that we have low self-confidence. It just means that we need to put in place the kind of policies that will allow Canadians to be exposed to their stories. We're at the point in our own cultural development where we need to go, okay, we got to keep accelerating this thing further. We can do it. I mean, Moment Factory, Gerard, Lepage, Solotech, out of Quebec, these people have done it. JFL has done it out of Quebec. But in English Canada is in a cultural crisis of gigantic proportions. And it has to be spoken about at conferences like this, and it has to be dealt with on some level.
Well, I'll just give you my opinion on this, but I don't think the government is responsible for I don't think the government's responsible for our entertainment production, although it does a phenomenal job, nor for our entertainment, period. Look, Matt, the story is this. I hate to be this blunt, but maybe Canadians don't give a rat's ass about their own stories. And I hate to be this blunt about it, but, you know, I don't think you can force feed a story on me if I don't want to hear it. The fact is the market chooses, the market decides, and the Quebec market has decided to hear its own story because of the fact that for a number of reasons, but one of the fact it's in its own language.
But there's impediments in the markets. Like, I've been brought up to Kamloops, I've been up out to Newfoundland, I've been brought all over the country to show my films at Canadian film festivals, at Cineplexes where normally only American product is shown.
I think that's great.
And the Canadians who see the Canadian films when they can love them, but because of the distribution system, they're blocked from seeing them except when these rotating film festivals bring the films there.
I just think that there's an openness now that didn't exist before. There's a distribution platform now that didn't exist before. And I think that, you know, it reminds me of a conversation I had years and years and years ago when I was a kid journalist with Burton Cummings. And that was just as the CRTC rules were put into effect. And I think the CRTC rules were great for Canadian music, phenomenal for Canadian music. Phenomenal, yes, for Canadian music. And he was pissed. He was pissed off. And he said, you know, we did it without that. We did it without this crutch. And they did. And really, guess who did it without the CRTC rules? And he said, well, why are we doing this? But in the end, I kind of get it. But the market will always decide. So I can put a film in a Cineplex, but if nobody comes, you know, don't blame the Cineplex. Don't blame the government. People don't want to watch it. But you're right. If you could, if more access, but the market will choose.
And get that film into the Cineplex. So, yeah, when there's 42 screens and there's two movies playing because 41 is not blocked.
And why? But for the reason, what does Cineplex sell?
Yeah.
What?
What? Because well.
What does Cineplex sell?
It's
popcorn. It's, thank exactly. you. If you have a movie called Eat More Goddamn Popcorn, Canada says Eat More Goddamn Popcorn, and you have a film that says you'll go watch it and they say, Holy Jesus Christ, I am sucking down Coke and eating popcorn. That will be the number one film in every
but
Cineplex across the country.
Just that. In Canadian cities, Universal and 20th Century Fox actually have employees who move the posters for the Canadian films to the back so that the people who are lining up and might see the poster don't actually see it.
Forget the poster. You know what? It's our job as a Canadian content maker. you can't rely on the corporations or the government to do the gig. They'll help you, they'll help you finance, but it's our job to make sure people come to it.
If
because
you can get
we,
onto
we, can,
stage.
We can, however, expect a level playing field. And now I have another question.
Hi. I really cut in line just because mine's kind of a good follow-up. I'm Emily. So I just, are we as Canadians then, it sounds like, and Andy was saying also, like then are we happy with mediocre? I mean, it's kind of like our constitution a little bit, seeing as this is Canadian studies. Our makeup or ethos of Canadians is thinking of the collective, participant culture, and always being democratic, which has served us very well on the world stage. And, you know, the States is a much more individualistic, you're going to be famous and the American dream, which serves better, I think, in the arts success world. I mean, my mother said to me, who's a doctor, said to me a few weeks ago, because I have aspirations of my own, and she said, look, I'm a family doctor. I'm very happy practicing in Ottawa. I'm not a neurosurgeon at Hopkins. She's fine with that. But if I want to be successful in what I want to do, I have to leave because there's no infrastructure here to support the Canadian talent that does exist. And
I think it's your job to define what your ultimates are in terms of how that expression has been used here today.
For sure. If you want to make it, though, to win an Oscar, and I mean, that is a goal of every filmmaker, I think, depending what type of films you do. But if you want to hit big, you have to, or be able to cross the border easily. And I don't think government allows actually that to happen, working in both spheres.
Emily, my dear, I'm sorry, but it's enraged me when I hear the word mediocre. Is this mediocre? I'm far from mediocre, and I live here.
No, you guys are far.
Is this conference mediocre? Is our education is McGill mediocre? You know, no. It drives me crazy.
No.
Canada, there's phenomenal things happening here. It is a great place to live, and there's a great art scene. Forget comparing it. Again, so put that wall, I said tear it down, put up the biggest goddamn wall around the country and say, you can't look or go anywhere else. And you look inside and say, you know, things are pretty good here. But mediocre, I don't accept it. I don't accept being mediocre. I don't accept the fact that, you know, going to the States is the ultimate, although I've done it and I've been back. So what? It's not mediocre. It's just create great stuff. Forget it. Forget it. Forget about this curtain of mediocrity that people get seem to put on us. I can't understand it.
It depends on what your definition of how far you want to go. You know what I mean? I don't think Canada's mediocre either, but I don't think there's any question that in a lot of certainly in sports, and I think in a lot of fields of endeavor, there are greater opportunities. There is a bigger market there. And we tend to, be angst-ridden about the fact that why can't I have all of that and stay here where I grew up? I'm not sure that, the really talented actor who grew up in Indiana is really angst-ridden about the fact that he can't have a fabulous, movie career and stay in Indiana and never go to California. Sometimes you chase where the huge opportunities are. But I'm kind of with Andy that I don't think that that equates into a culture of mediocrity here, certainly in sports. But I do think that we've got a sense in Canada that it's not always necessarily about the gold medal. You know what I mean? And the recent example I'd point to is the Canadian women's soccer team at the Olympics in London. They came home with a bronze. You know what? That felt like a gold to me, as far as I'm concerned. The way that that team played, the odds that they overcame, the way they represented this country, what felt like a huge, huge win to me. I don't care what color that bronze was, and I don't think that means that I support a culture of mediocrity at all. I think that I define success in a broader way than just who came out on top of the podium.
No, and for the record, I don't think we're mediocre at all here.
I didn't think
but I just different
levels. Time, I think something that we haven't really talked about here, but at the same time, I think we have a real responsibility to host success from other countries as well. So to invite those people who are doing incredible things to come back into our country and to do things here and to be very present. So I think there's a responsibility to be a kind of host to success in the world as well. It's a very important part of the whole process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Straw?
Will Straw. One of the questions we were toying around with when we were organizing this conference, it was already mentioned, was in Australia they have this thing called tall poppy syndrome, or they say they do, whereby if someone gets too big for their britches, too successful,
there's a tendency to disown them. And people said, oh, we have that in Canada too, but I don't actually think we do. I think we have the opposite, which is that someone gets too successful, has lived somewhere else for 40 years, we still cling to them. Like Neil Young, we say, oh, could they, you know, as if they're, we give them awards every year. We hang on to them rather than cutting them down. So we have the opposite. I don't know what the opposite of a tall poppy syndrome would be, but we sort of, there's a clinginess that is the opposite. Do you think that's the case? Or, I mean, how do we deal with those who've gone on and made it elsewhere?
I agree with that. Sorry, I'll be very quick. I know I'm talking a lot. But I agree with that. The people that we cut down are the people who grow up here, go elsewhere, become hugely successful, and then turn around and say, Canada's lousy. I had to get out of there. We hate that because I think we all recognize the fact that if you grew up here, you are subject to an enormous range of benefits that form the foundation of your future success. And it seems incredibly ungrateful for you to go on and have huge worldwide success elsewhere and turn around and crap on your home country. I think that is the thing that inflames Canadians more than anything.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Robert Leckie. I'm not bothered that Canadian people might take opportunities elsewhere, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts on whether we're actually good at recognizing at home Canadian talent. And I'll just give an example. It was recently discussed that Javier Lepage has never been invited to create an opera for L'Opéra de Montréal. He's invited in New York to do that. Do you have any sense whether we're good at recognizing the potential of Canadian artists to do things at home, or whether we still somehow sort of, I guess, imagine that if things are foreign, they're better? Any sense on that?
I think we do a good job. But if you see like a young Canadian artist goes off to London and has a show, and actually a lot of critics start to look at that, you know, London is a kind of microphone to the world, a megaphone to the world. There's tons of press there. German press comes, international press comes to London. So right away, like, an artist can kind of become really well known quite quickly. In a way, in Canada, even though we have great media, et cetera, it's small and it's kind of, you know, it's just across the country. We all get to know. We're a small group of people. We know each other in the fields here. But yeah, you know, I think things happen at different speeds in different places. So
I think, you know, I don't know the economics of it, and believe me, I can't be further away from anything in life than opera. But knowing just the economics of showbiz, the Opera de Montréal, Lepage may be too expensive. I mean, we invite Canadians back all the time. And they say, oh, you know, wouldn't it be nice? We would love to celebrate you. And then they throw a price tag at us. We say, I'm sorry, economically, we just can't afford that. So I'm not making excuses for L'Opéra de Montréal, but let me tell you, I don't think for a second they wouldn't want to work with Lepage.
And I can't comment on the Opéra de Montréal, but the Canadian Opera Country in Toronto has brought Robert Lepage and François and Adam McGuigan, et cetera, to direct operas. So maybe it's just a question of taste. I don't know.
But my synagogue opera company invited Lepage, but he had to donate the money back, so they said that.
No, but that was the other Lepage. That was the glue. Audacity. That was the guy from the glue. Yes.
Hi, I'm Hi. Shannon, and, Hi. You know, as I can see, you all have gone really far in your lives, so I was wondering if you could give me some examples of strategies you've used over the years in order to network yourself and, you know, meet new people, gain new opportunities.
I can offer you what has worked for me and my company is we tend to work again and again with the same creative collaborators, so we've developed like a posse. So I've worked on 7 or 8 films with Don McKellar. I've worked with the same DOP on the last 4 films. I've worked with the same editor, the same sound mixer, the same sound designer, the same composer. So you develop a team of like-minded creative collaborators, and with them you move forward.
I'll give you a bit of advice. One, don't be shy, but using your parents, whoever you can, whatever leverage you have, whatever patronage you have, get in, because it doesn't matter how you get in, it means getting in. And once you're there, I'm going to tell you how to stay. In fact, I just wrote about this. I had a blog post in Huffington Post, and I just wrote about this week, so it's fresh, thankfully. There's 3 things. It's, you know, when you have to be interesting, because interesting stands out, boring is overlooked. You have to be a pain in the ass, and I know it's counterintuitive, but being a pain in the ass means like you're challenging, you're upsetting some apple carts, you're challenging some paradigms, you're making people think differently. It's like, geez, what's this person thinking about? And then you have to make yourself indispensable. But you got to get in first, and in is whichever way you can, but once you're in, you know, you got to stay in. That's interesting, pain in the ass, and then indispensable. And then one day you'll be sitting up here giving out advice when you really don't have the credibility to do so, just like me. So.
I just want to add one thing. I think that people who are interesting are interested. There is an absolute relationship between the two. And you know what I don't find is a lot of people who are interested. I meet a lot of young filmmakers, for example, and they say, and I ask them about other movies. Oh, I didn't see it. What do you mean you didn't see it? Like, you don't have to see every movie that comes out. But if you're not really constantly impassioned by what it is you believe you think you should be doing, and that means knowing the work of all the other people around you and knowing what goes on in sports or in art or making yourself interested, you are never going to be interesting.
Thank you.
Ken Dryden, just a couple of points.
Who are you?
One of them has to do with a point you made, Steve, about the Olympics and about Australia. I remember after the London Games, I decided to look at the results of Canada in the London Games and in the Vancouver Games, and look at Canada's performance compared to other countries in both the Summer and Winter Games. Some countries are winter countries. Some are summer countries. There are very few that are both. Russia is, China is, the U.S. is, Germany is, but most others are, you know, do well in one or the other. I don't remember exactly what the statistics were. I'd have to check them. But it was something like Canada, I think, was around 10th in terms of overall. And so, you know, just to make the point that, you know, and I think it's, you know, picking up the spirit of what Andy is saying, I think we're doing a lot better than we think we are doing and that we say about ourselves as doing. The second point, in terms of the model of development, at one time, the participation model was the model for everything. The way in which you developed an athlete, the way you developed most people in any kind of field, was through mass participation. And the assumption was is that the more people who participate, eventually those that are special will work their way to the top. And they will get elite opportunities. But there weren't elite programs. The program was for everybody. Now that's changed, and changed significantly. And where, in fact, you can reach the top, and in fact, you only do reach the top, and in most fields, I think in arts as well as sports, by engaging yourself in elite activities early on. It's not mass participation that does it anymore. And one of the things that came up a bit yesterday, and I think that, you know, it requires a different way of thinking about this, is that at one time, and you gave the example of Milos Raonic, what would happen historically if there was a Milos Raonic is that once he did as well as he did, the phones would be off the hook at tennis clubs for the next couple of weeks with parents signing up their kids. And given a mass participation model, you'd get that many more kids. The demands on them wouldn't be overwhelming. They'd stay as tennis players, and eventually, with that greater mass, they would produce some new Miloses. That isn't the case anymore. The phones may run off the hook for the next week or so, but given that, in fact, you only make it if you're in an elite program, as Milos has been and the rest of it, is that very quickly most drop out. They decide that they don't want that for their lives, or their parents don't want to live that kind of a family life. And so if we think that there's a connection between winning gold medals, mass participation, and fitness and obesity, historically there was, and now there isn't. And we hope that by winning medals, we will somehow create greater participation, which will create greater fitness, greater health, less obesity. There's almost no connection any longer.
They are three different levels. There's the elite level, and the question is, do we want to support the elite level? There is kind of a mass involvement level, and then there's a fitness and health level in the whole thing. And we like to think that there's spillover in all of them, and by doing one, we're doing the rest, and that's what justifies our investment in these things. But it really doesn't work that way anymore.
I agree with that, Ken. The point that I was trying to make is just that by focusing overwhelming, much like you're saying, on we need more gold medals because that will spawn more gold medals, I think is just looking at it the wrong way. I think about a young guy like Andrew Wiggins. If you haven't heard of Andrew Wiggins yet, you will soon. He's a high school age basketball player from Toronto who is playing at a prep school in Virginia right now. He is the number one recruit for the NCAA heading in to this year's recruiting class. He is, knock on wood, barring injury, he is going to be something really special. But this is a kid who was kind of fostered in the growth of grassroots participation of basketball in the Toronto area in particular, in Montreal as well, over the past 10 years. He was a transcendent talent who was identified, in middle school and has now gone down to the United States to continue to develop that talent. To me, it's not about we need to produce more Andrew Wiggins, but Andrew Wiggins will produce more basketball players, and in that pool, some will bubble to the top.
My point is that there's no real grassroots. He didn't grow up in grassroots. Grassroots in basketball, like in hockey, almost instantly becomes elite. Mm-hmm. And where it's like a piano prodigy,
right,
that you end up living a prodigy's life. Mm-hmm. It's just a very different living model now.
Right.
Could I just bring up two quick points here? One is, I hate to be cynical, but I think that the more gold medals mean more advertising dollars for Rogers or for Bell or for the company broadcasting the Olympics.
That's great news.
Yes, I know. But the point is, I really think that it's a commercial thing more than it is an athletic thing. I really do believe the support thing, the participation thing comes up. But if I can, just sustaining a career in Canada, if I can, what makes us different? I think really what makes us different after working in Canada, working in the States, we're human beings. And I'm going to give you, I'm going to give you a story, because Ken Dryden got up, and you don't even know this story, but how we connected about 30 years ago, perhaps maybe longer. But I'll just give you the story very quickly. I was a kid reporter. This is the difference I think this is a great metaphor for Canada versus the rest of the world in terms of entertainment. I was a kid reporter. I was 18 years old. I got the gig. I was covering the opposite teams as the Canadians were doing their playoff run in '79. And sometimes I would go into the Canadians' dressing rooms to get quotes. So remember, I'm 19 years old. My hair's down to my shoulders. I have acne. I'm jeans. I'm a schlepper. But I'm doing my job. So I go in the Canadians' dressing room after a win. I'm there with my little tape recorder, and I'm in front of Ken Dryden getting quotes like this. And who comes next to me? No, he was sitting.
Okay.
I was standing, so we were about the same height. And so who comes next to me is Regent Tremblay. And for those who don't know Regent Tremblay, he is the cock of the walk as it pertains to sports reporters in Montreal, perhaps in Canada. So Regent Tremblay comes right next to me, and he's the guy, he's the god, La Presse, he's the god of sports reporters, and he comes up to me, and I'm standing on the tape recorder, and he basically does this, goes, pushes it out of the way, and goes into Ken Dryden and asks the question. And I'll never forget this, and Ken Dryden looks at him and says, excuse me, sir, I'll be with you as soon as I finish answering this gentleman's questions. Until then, I ask you to wait, and once I'm done with him, I'll be happy to answer your question. And he brought my tape recorder right back, answered it. I said, thank you. He said, thank you. And Tremblay went to ask his question. So that, in a nutshell, is what Canadian showbiz is all about. So you don't know that, but that's a true story. And I tell it very, very often. That's the difference. Because the other way is, thank you very much. You're not important. I'm going to the important guy. And screw yourself. And if he did that, imagine how the story would be. I'm up here right now. It would be a revenge story. So.
But the real reason was because you had long hair, and Regent has the worst comb over in the world.
Hey, listen, a little bit of envy, perhaps, but that was a long time ago.
Yes. Any more questions? Nobody's in line. Yes, sir.
So I wanted to talk about this microphone.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that Canada does is it gives you a chance to tinker. I think about the examples of people who become great. I think what we're talking about in sustaining a career is competition. You get better when you compete. When you compete, you know you're good. You work on something, you get better. I think about the example of the Guess Who, former Winnipegger. You read about the biography. It was Sunday afternoon. They're at his mother's place. They're playing chords. They're working on things. They're innovating. They're trying things. Just so happens that they got their asses kicked. Using your language. It's a competition because just so happens that Neil Young is having a social down the street, and someone attended theirs and didn't attend theirs, right? They went to his because his was better. So they got together on Sunday, they did the chords, they did the work, they came up with some music, and then they competed. I was a kid at the time, and I know what it was like. Which social did you go to? Well, I went to the South Winnipeg social because Neil Young was performing. What are you doing next weekend? Well, I'm going to the Guess Who because, well, they're better than Neil Young was last week. It's competition. It's the opportunity to compete and measure yourself and get better and innovate. And I think that's what it is. That what Canada does is give us that opportunity to schlep, to tinker, to work at our craft. And then the internet gives us that opportunity to compete. And I just think that government and public policy just has to give us the opportunity to compete. And then we know how good we are, how we measure up. And if it gives us the feedback, then we continue, we get better.
I got to say one thing. I know all the government policy in the world, but one thing that's the scariest, the rest of the world does not care about Canadian government policy. The rest of the world doesn't care about our laws. They don't care about the CRTC. Netflix doesn't care about what our law. They don't care. So when the competition around the world doesn't care, don't think that laws here are going to protect you. They're not. They will help you. They'll help you get off the ground. But the rest of the world does not care about the laws this government puts into place to protect
its... But the rest of the world, you'll have to admit, does care about its own laws to protect its own cultures.
Jack Valenti.
Every yeah. culture in the world is protected,
mm-hmm.
including American culture. So I don't really see why we apologize for that. We have to. I mean, go back to your elephant. You know, I mean... And it's just the scale of 10 to 1. I mean, I don't want to be depressing about this, but, you know, it's just 10 to 1. You have 10 great, you know, there's 10 crappy things about America, there's one Canadian. There's 10 great things about America, there's two Canadian. We'll just change the scale. And this thing has been driving me insane. You know, there's this thing that flashes the time. I feel like there's a spring in this chair that's going to explode. I do believe we're over. Thank you all very much for coming. We're 4, 3, 2, 1.
Perfect.
Thank you all.
What timing?
Thank you all for a fantastic panel. Kevin, for your expert moderation. On va passer maintenant à la pause café. J'aimerais juste vous rappeler qu'on a un hashtag, and yesterday in the afternoon for a while that hashtag was trending, which means it was one of the most popular hashtags. Now, this thrilled us here. You might think that's a shallow thing to get thrilled about, but it really, really made us happy. So if you are sitting there thinking of tweeting, please do so. Post Cafe, coffee break. Please be back at 10:45 for the next very interesting panel.